It happens to every home cook. You follow a recipe to the letter, but then get a decidedly lackluster result. More often than not, you blame the recipe for what went wrong, the fallen cake or the overdone brisket. On today's Please Explain, we will look into the art of crafting the perfect recipe. And joining me now are Deb Perlman, author of the popular blog SmittenKitchen.com, and John Doc Willoughby, the executive editor of the America's Test Kitchen Cookbooks. Hello and welcome to our show. And we invite our audience to call in at any time at 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Doc, did you get your nickname in connection with writing recipes?
No, I got it long before I started writing recipes. I got my nickname in connection with the fact that I moved to the East Coast and, in the opinion of my college roommates, dressed like a country doctor.
Well, let's talk about recipes. Did the ancients write recipes?
I don't believe they did. I mean, the first American recipe books are, I think, in the 1700s. It was a, you know, most people learned to cook at, you know, right at home. Everybody cooked all the time, and you cooked with what you had. And the idea of writing something down and following something else's, somebody else's ideas for how to cook, I think, is a distinctly modern kind of idea.
Well, Deb, I've had meals that purported to be pre-Columbian, for example, Italian, before there were tomatoes and all sorts of other things available. And I wonder how they even knew. Somebody must have written something down.
It's entirely possible that they were watching somebody cook, and that's how they learned. But also it's intuition. You know, if you taste as you go and you're feeling it out and you're trying to get towards a certain place, it's either cooked enough or it's not. So maybe we had to rely on intuition a lot more.
Actually, I take it back. There were Roman cookbooks.
I'm relieved.
Yes.
And I wonder what would happen if we cooked from them, whether we would get a meal that anybody would find tasty today.
I very much doubt it. Things have changed. I mean, we at Cook's Country Magazine, we were working on a recipe from the 1800s. Couldn't get it to work, and finally figured out that cream is very different today than the cream they were using back then. And that's only a couple of hundred years. So I can imagine if you tried to cook a Roman recipe, you would be out of luck.
Well, can we assume that recipes have gotten more specific as the level of basic cooking knowledge of home cooks has diminished, Deb?
I would definitely say so, that there's a lot more detail there. And, you know, I was looking at the two recipes you have on the website today, the older version and the newer one, and I could see how a beginner cook would be a little overwhelmed by the lack of detail in the original recipe, not to mention that some of those ingredients, you wouldn't have it laid out if you were reading it that way. You know, the whole idea of doing mise to pre-measure all of your ingredients, you know, it's definitely helpful with the flow of a recipe.
Well, Doc, Deb is referring to these two recipes for devil's food cake that we posted on our blog that you provided. One is from the Fanny Farmer Cookbook, which was published at the turn of the 20th century, and the other is from a recent issue of Cook's Magazine, and there's a 30-line difference between the two.
Yeah, it's kind of impressive, isn't it?
So why is the Cook's recipe so much longer? Have we become stupid?
Well, I think we've become inexperienced. I mean, when I was at Gourmet and we were looking back at the old recipes from the 40s, one of them started with pluck, clean, and cook two ducks. So they just assumed that everyone knew how to do that. That's a useless recipe to us today. I think we are now writing for people who are in the kitchen occasionally or maybe even the first time and not experienced. And particularly with something like a cake, you really have to tell people everything.
Well, to some, especially cake, because it's almost scientific, and measurement is very important.
I would agree with that. I mean, having a food website that gets a lot of comments, I would say that there is almost no question that I don't get asked per recipe. I've learned to, like, almost anticipate. So I'm reading through that Cook's Illustrated recipe, and I'm thinking, unbleached all-purpose flour. Is it? Could you not use bleached flour? I know that Cook's Illustrated tends to prefer unbleached, but would it not work with the other pieces? I will get that comment. Somebody's going to ask me if they can use coarse salt.
And what answer would you give that person?
I would say that, well, I'm not the recipe's creator, but my hunch is that you could use either flour and be happy with the results. There's one that is more ideal, but I would let people know that you could use both so they don't have to go to the store. Because some people will do that. They will run to the store just to buy a different flour because they're so nervous in the kitchen. They're, you know, there's so little confidence there. So I see things and I see more places where I might add alternatives, letting people know what the best version is, but what will also work.
My guess
would make it even longer.
Deb Perlman, whose blog is smittenkitchen.com. John Willoughby, the executive editor of the America's Test Kitchen Cookbooks. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Let's go through the basics, Doc. What are the different parts of a recipe? Is there a particular form that must be followed? And the reason I ask is, for many years, Gourmet magazine didn't list the ingredients at the top of a recipe. Right. They obviously had a reason for that.
Well, the original recipe style was sort of paragraph style, sort of as if you were talking somebody through it in their kitchen. And I think that was fine for cooks who are used to operating that way and who have a big pantry. But now we changed to having all the ingredients listed at the top so people can take this to the store or easily make a list, because people tend not to have a lot of stuff on hand these days. So that is pretty standard. You have the title, you have a little head note that tells people whatever you want to know about the recipe. Then you have the ingredient list in the order the ingredients are used, and then the instructions.
Deb, the thing that always confuses me is the suggested preparation time.
I mean, how tough one.
How is that even calculated?
You know what? I imagine the different recipe writers do it differently. They're probably estimating how long it took them in their kitchen. It might seem like an underestimate to a lot of home cooks, especially if you're newer at things. I mean, it could take me, you know, years ago, forever to chop an onion. It could take, you know, you never know. And also the power of stoves. I've learned that my low on my stove is much higher than the low of other people. So there's so many things that you pick up. I would say that the estimates in most recipes are not something you should too closely rely your cooking on.
Don't count on them.
Well, there was an article on Slate recently that claimed that all preparation times are inaccurate. But that's because we are all different. I probably am a lot slower in chopping an onion than somebody who works in a kitchen.
Went to cooking school, and they absolutely had to do it quickly. I'm kind of a leisurely cook myself. I'm a home cook. I'm not on a line where I have to get a certain amount of prep done before dinner, so I can take my time. And so I am much more careful and slow in the kitchen. Also, there's a whole other thing going on right now where Google's introduced this recipe search, and one of the things that they're filing these recipes by is how long they take. So you're going to see a lot of recipes sort of bluffing a bit and trying to make themselves sound quicker so they'll get more people, more traffic to their site. If you actually said, well, it might take you 10 minutes to chop two large onions, I mean, nobody's going to make it. They want to make 30-minute recipes. So you might see even more fudging of times.
Doc, Amanda Hesse wrote about that on her website, Food 54. She said her concern was that they gave you three different, they sorted recipes by preparation time, nutritional value, and ingredients.
Right.
And all of those can be very limiting. She also argued that by narrowing the search options to two things that are notoriously difficult for food bloggers and home cooks to measure, nutrition information and prep time, Google has inadvertently, perhaps, prioritized big food sites like allrecipes.com.
Absolutely. I totally agree with her with that. And, you know, the preparation times, the way we do it is, you know, you measure how long it takes the cook to do it, and then you add 10%. And that's still going to be, you know, that's the way I do it when I'm writing for the Times, for example. It's still going to be quick for a lot of home cooks. So they're just a sort of a general guideline, and I don't think it's really that useful to search based on that. But, you know, it is going to force a lot of people to put on times, even though they know they're sort of inaccurate.
Before we get to our listeners' questions, I would like to ask you about looking at old recipes and modernizing them. How do you calculate measurements when you're duplicating a dish from someone who doesn't use recipes? If you speak to a chef, I know chefs have talked about making putting together recipes, and they'll do something, and the person who's writing the cookbook with them will say, wait a minute, and then they'll put it into a cup, or they'll put it into a spoon or something just to measure it. The cook never thinks that way.
I mean, you would really just have to test it out in your home kitchen if you're rewriting that recipe or trying to translate it to home cooked. You'd have to do a lot of testing, and I'm sure Cooks Illustrated, Cooks Country agrees with this too. I mean, most people who write recipes would love it if everyone at home just got a kitchen scale, especially when it comes to baking. You can get one for like $10 or $15, and your recipes will always be accurate. You'll never.
But that's only if you're told to what the measure weight by
is,
the weight.
Of course.
And often you're not told that.
Yes. I try to provide weights with my recipes, but it's not a completely consistent thing. I would love to see. I'm delighted when I come across a cake recipe or a baking recipe that has weights, because I know that I'm going to get the exact result that's intended, or as close to exact as possible.
Well, some old recipes, I've seen an old Italian cookbook that said, measure it in a wine glass. Now, I have a whole bunch of wine glasses in my house. Which one do I choose? And then there are all these old recipes that simply say, cook until done.
Right. That's what chefs love. You ask them, how long does it take? How long do they cook it? And they always say, until it's done.
But in a way that, of course, you have to know when it's done. But haven't we all had the experience where the recipe said, cook it at a 350-degree oven for 40 minutes, and it's either overdone or underdone at that time?
That's why I think you always have to give people visual clues, some kind of clue to know when it's actually done. So you can say about 40 minutes or until, you know, the old test with the toothpick in the cake or whatever works for whatever you're cooking. You have to give a time and something that people can actually test it with.
I think sometimes we get into the realm of too much information, though, because I think with a cake, if the tester doesn't come out clean, the cake is not done, period. It doesn't matter what color it is. It doesn't matter. You know, you definitely have ovens that brown things more quickly, and it's not a pleasant thing. A lot of home ovens, most ovens are not calibrated, and so you might think you're cooking at 350, but you're really cooking at 400. But that aside, I feel like the toothpick test is all that matters when it comes to a cake or a baked good like that.
If it comes out dry?
I mean, or sometimes it'll be like a few crumbs clinging to the toothpick, and anything else to me is just, I don't know, extra words.
What you always have to find is the how to give people enough information to have them create what you want them to create or what you created, what you have in mind, without giving them too little or too much. And you're always searching for that sort of sweet spot on what's enough to guide inexperienced cooks and not so much that they either are confused or intimidated by a recipe that looks like a book.
People have been writing in. One writes, one of my worst disasters is when I was trying to duplicate my husband's mother's famous fudge cake. That's always dangerous, isn't it, to do something that
you're not going to do
your mother-in-law
right.
did.
You can't win.
It wound up shaped like a football unintentionally, and the fudge frosting kept falling off the cake. I would shore it up on one side only to have it fall off on the other. Needless to say, I've never tried to make it again. Would that have been because the recipe writer just assumed certain that you knew certain things?
Sabotage. It's probably the recipe writers, though. It is. I mean, because they've been making it for a million years, and so they're not writing it in a way that's trying to think of everything. You know, that I think when recipe writers have this advantage of getting a lot of feedback from their readership, as I'm sure Cook's Country does, and I get a lot, you learn to just anticipate so many things, such as the fact that not everybody knows that cakes should be real cool when you frost them, or it's just going to slide right off. And
so that's what she probably did wrong.
It could have been that, or, you know, sabotage.
Jane in Brooklyn writes, I'd love to know if there's a trick to making hollandaise sauce. There are so many recipes out there, some that require double boilers, others a basic saucepan or a blender or a whisk. I haven't succeeded with any of them. Is there a fail-proof or near-fail-proof version out there?
Blender.
Yeah, I would say blender.
It's really great. It's this. I just learned about this a couple of years ago, and all of a sudden I'm somebody who can whip up hollandaise sauce, and it's not because I'm a spectacular cook. It's a real good method. It saves you a lot of time. Please don't make me read the recipe from memory. But it's basically like you get those egg yolks real whipped up till they're, you know, white and ribbony, and then you drizzle in the melted butter, and you literally make butter mayonnaise. It's delicious.
Karen on Facebook left this recipe disaster story. Embarrassed to say, but my worst ever was fudge. From all that I'd heard from friends with kids, the recipe on the container of marshmallow fluff was foolproof, but mine never set. It remained too runny to be fudge and too hard to be fudge sauce. I even put it in the freezer, but it didn't even freeze set. It just separated and started oozing a mysterious clear liquid. So I let it drool out of the container straight into the trash can. It's highly possible that I made an error while doubling the recipe, but I couldn't for the life of me figure out what I'd done wrong. Was trusting in marshmallow fluff my first mistake? Those recipes are usually tested to be pretty foolproof, aren't they? I mean, whether you think marshmallow fluff is the way to go is a whole other matter.
You know, recipes on the back of packages, you know, they are very, very dependable. But doubling a recipe is always a little trickier than it seems, unless, you know, like you're grilling steaks, you can grill two steaks. But anytime there's chemistry involved, doubling is not always as straightforward as it seems. So you have to be a little careful about that.
What about cutting it in half? Same sort of problem?
Same problem.
We have to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll be taking your calls at 646-829-3985 or continue leaving comments on our show page at WNYC.org. My guests are John Doc Willoughby, the executive editor of the America's Test Kitchen cookbooks, and Deb Perlman, author of the popular blog SmittenKitchen.com. Stay with us. We're back with Deb Perlman and John Doc Willoughby talking about how to write a recipe and how to follow a recipe on today's Please Explain Look at Recipes. And we are taking your calls at 646-829-3985. People are also writing in to our show page and leaving comments. And let's go to one of the calls. Our first caller is I'm having a problem getting this caller on the air. Are you there, Edward? Edward?
Yes, yes, I'm here.
Okay.
I have a question. I am attempting to make, and I'm learning so much from you guys today. I love to eat chocolate souffle, and I worked at a gourmet restaurant 20 years ago, so I like to try different places. And it's quite expensive sometimes when you try and find a good one. I'm attempting to do my, you know, make my own, so I know there's no foolproof method. I know that when I watched them in the kitchen 20 years ago, they would whip them up, and they would make mistakes sometimes, and they wouldn't come out perfect, and, you know, they would have to start over. So I kind of want to get a little advice before I attempt this. Maybe the oven temperature or the eggs, beating the eggs by hand rather than using a blender.
Which one of you wants to respond? No? Okay, Doc?
Souffle. I'm just checking out the chocolate souffle. I am not actually, I don't think I've ever made a chocolate souffle myself, but there is a chocolate souffle in Cook's Illustrated where we basically said the most important thing is to not use too much milk. For a full chocolate flavor, you want to separate the eggs, increase the amount of chocolate, and reduce the amount of butter. So, but it's it's a pretty traditional chocolate souffle recipe.
Isn't one of the problems with a souffle that not all ovens are the same? I've had real problems trying to figure out when my oven is what it says it's at.
You should get a $3 oven thermometer.
No, I have a thermometer, but it varies over the time. You can't keep on checking every 10 minutes.
They're like 25 degrees apart from the front left to the back right. I have two oven thermometers.
And I think electric ovens tend to be more accurate than gas ovens.
They tend to be more steady. As Deb says, mm-hmm. The problem is not only that the oven temperature isn't, you know, accurate per se, but that different parts of the oven are at different temperatures. So when you're making something like a souffle, I mean, one test
could you
like
turn
to do,
it around?
You could turn it around, but the best thing to do is put in two cookie sheets in your oven with pieces of bread on them and put it to 350 or 400 and let it sit for half an hour and then take them out and look at the bread, and it will show you the patterns of where the heat is higher depending on how toasted the bread is. And then there's not a lot you can do to adjust your oven, but once you know where the hotter and cooler spots are, you can use that. So if the left portion of your oven is hotter, you might want to put the souffle over there. So, 'cause ovens are kind of crude tools, and they work great, but each one is a little bit different.
Well, I've been talking to the two of you as though you never make mistakes. Have you had your cooking disasters?
Of course, and I always blame the recipe.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. No, of course.
We would all you try it again if something went wrong?
Absolutely.
And see if it was you? Or can you, since you're sophisticated, both of you, when you're reading a recipe, do you sometimes notice that there is a step missing or a detail that you think should have been included?
Red flags all the time. I always, like, I'll say that is just way too much butter for a cake. Like, where is that going to go? And especially when it comes to baking, I think it's very easy to eyeball what's going on. And you can look at, sometimes I look at proportions. I have a few favorite cakes. And, you know, I mean, baking is very much about proportions. And when I see an ingredient that's really out of proportion, it like raises a flag, and I'm very careful as I'm making it, and then I try to see if I'm not happy with it, was it about that thing that was out of whack. That doesn't, I guess, help other people too much. But even with a, you know, something like a brisket too, though, there's cooking times, and you just see in 8 hours that that's going to go real badly. You can just tell it's going to be real bad.
Well, let's go ahead. Listeners are asking about substitutions: baking soda, baking powder, buttermilk.
Mm-hmm.
Can you, if you don't have buttermilk in the house, can you just take yogurt and thin it out with milk? Will you get the same result?
Similar.
You get a similar result. I mean, you can make your own clabbered milk, you know, which is closer to buttermilk than yogurt and regular milk. Just put some vinegar in and let it sit for a while until it's, clabbered. And if you use that in baking, you won't notice that much difference, but if you use it in other applications where it's not part of a, part of a mix of baking, it will taste different.
Well, you're putting lemon into regular milk and that's it?
You put vinegar or lemon into regular milk. Vinegar is a little better because it doesn't have as strong a taste as lemon juice, and you let it sit for 20 minutes, and you'll have clabbered milk, which operates in a cake very similarly to buttermilk. But you wouldn't want to use it in a, if you're just using it uncooked.
But what kind of vinegar? I have about 6 different vinegars in my cupboard.
We used white distilled vinegar.
Yeah, distilled vinegar.
White distilled. You see? You've
got to
get very specific.
They're not generally as acidic. But, oh, no, I would absolutely say I think everybody should keep it around anyway. But, no, you'd want to be specific. And I also think that a lot of times I see it, and it's not so specific as to say that you should really wait 10 to 20 minutes until it looks clabbered. Because if you just mix it together, you may not get that. The effect that you want. But I would, in recipes, I always let people know when the alternative would work, or I try to save you a trip to the store.
And then somebody else was wondering about the difference between baking powder and baking soda. There, baking powder is partly made of baking soda, isn't it?
It is, and you can't really use them interchangeably because one reacts with acid and decreases the amount of acid in the recipe, and the other doesn't. I have to admit, I've read and edited about this 100 times. I can never remember which is which. But they're not interchangeable. And if you use the same amount of one as if the other is called for, you won't get the right result.
You're also using, for maybe a cake or something like that, you're using about a quarter teaspoon of baking soda per cup of flour. You would want to use 1 teaspoon of baking powder. So it's a much different volume. And also, I think baking powder is double acting, which is that I think it reacts once when you mix it and a second time when it hits heat. Baking soda is single acting, so it's a little bit less reliable, though most old recipes use baking soda.
Well, there's a lot of talk about scones these days because of what just happened in London. And I've noticed, because I lived in England for a while, where the scones were just fabulous, that here they taste of baking soda often. And I wonder it's because it's different here, or because people just use more baking soda in their scones.
I always thought that the problem, and I could be completely wrong, was that a lot of people complain they have a baking powdery taste, and I thought it had to do with using non-alkalized. Of course, the word's completely slipping. Sorry, I'm having a total brain fart.
But what happens when you make something and it has that kind of bitter taste that you associate with baking powder, baking soda?
I would actually first recommend that people would switch to an aluminum-free. That was the word I was thinking. Aluminum-free baking powder, because those tend to impart much less metallic taste. The ones with aluminum in them, I think Davis is like the classic brand that has aluminum in it. It's going to react with fruit. And by the way, Doc is going to probably give you a much more authentic answer, but it's going to react with fruit and often have that metallic taste that people don't like. And just switching to an aluminum-free will greatly improve the flavor.
You agree?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. That is important. But also, a lot of people use a lot of leavener because it will make sure that things rise, but you can often cut back by quite a bit, and you're still going to have the rise, and you won't get that taste. And it's one of the reasons that sometimes you'll see a recipe that has both baking powder and baking soda in it, because you can get, as Deb said, one is double acting and one is single acting, so you can get enough rise using smaller amounts of the two of them together.
Now, what are your thoughts about all of these cookbooks from celebrity chefs? Recently, we have this trend in the food world, the rise of molecular gastronomy, things like aerated foie gras and liquid nitrogen. Can you even duplicate those things without setting up a chemistry lab in your kitchen?
Well, that kind of things you can't really duplicate, but chef cookbooks in general, you know, they're very variable. You can't really generalize about them. Like Ad Hoc at Home by Keller is an amazing book, and there's books that I won't mention where you can't use any of the recipes because the chefs didn't really try them at home. So, you know, it's a very variable field. Well,
although even Ad Hoc at Home, I have a friend who made the coffee ice cream recipe, and he was stunned that it required 10 eggs. So I mentioned that to Thomas Keller, who said, oh, he could have used a dozen.
Mm-hmm. I know. The egg yolks and ice cream, it just gets richer and better. You could also make it with less if you're in a pinch, but, you know, it's going to taste better with more.
Soigne from Madison, New Jersey writes, I understand that recipes cannot be copyrighted. When publishing your own recipes, are there any rules of thumb as to whether to attribute your own recipe as an adaptation of another? For example, you're inspired by a recipe published by another and you develop your own similar recipe for publication on your own. When I have crossed from inspiration to adaptation.
When in doubt,
it's a slippery slope. Yeah, exactly. When in doubt, attribute it and say, you know, I was inspired by this recipe. You know, no one is going to think less of you. And, as I said, they can't be copyrighted. You can change the amount of salt and the amount of pepper in a recipe, and then it becomes technically, legally yours. But, you know, if you started out with something, an inspiration from somebody's recipe, and you've been cooking it for 2 years and it's now a totally different recipe, it's still good to say, you know, I first got this idea from so-and-so.
And there have been accusations of plagiarism.
I'm very
suspicious the cookbook world.
When I see recipes that aren't attributed, it just sounds a little weird to me that, you know, that maybe, I mean, unless you're America's Test Kitchen, that you'd be, you know, putting butter and flour together for the first time. At the same time, it's lists of ingredients that can't be copyrighted. Everything else is. All the instructions, all the head notes, that's completely original work. And so if you're using any of those sentences, you are using copyrighted material. You're supposed to be putting the stuff in your own words, in your own language. You're supposed to be adding to it, or you're just literally creating a copy of an existing work.
Sam Grobart, writing in the New York Times, argued that cookbooks were obsolete. He thought that recipe apps would be the future of cooking. Do the both of you agree?
Well, it's very odd. I would have thought that with, you know, recipe apps and all the online recipes, cookbooks would sort of go the way of the dinosaur. They are one of the few parts of the book business that's booming. People love to have cookbooks. There's something about having them in the kitchen or, you know, reading them in bed, which people do. And obviously, you can get recipes, 1,000 recipes on the Internet for anything you want to make, but cookbooks are still doing well.
Well, I like being able to go back to the cookbook every time I get nervous. And if you're going from the Internet, you either have to print the thing, which is, how is that all that different?
Or
than
you make
going
a mess
a
of your phone or your iPad.
Yeah.
And I think it's just about the medium. I mean, some people are going to always, you know, prefer print newspapers. Some people are going to always prefer cookbooks. I'm actually sort of a little bit on the fence about it because I've had just a recipe website for years, and I've never really felt the whole, I didn't understand the cookbook thing, but I'm going to find out because I'm writing one now.
You'll find out.
I'm about to find out. Maybe we'll see if people want to read things in print.
No, I think they really, it's been very interesting to me. The cookbook business is still booming. There's something about, the photographs are different in print than they are online, and I think there's really something very satisfying about having that book.
Amelia in Tarrytown writes, I'm a big fan of Deb's and would love for her to work her updating magic with some of Elizabeth David's recipes.
Wow.
I find the measurements so confusing and vague. What is a gill, for example?
Oh, my God. I could Google it, and I would have an answer for you very quickly.
So is that what you should do, just simply look at Google a gill?
Well, you know, Google it and look for the answer to be the same a few times. This is a very authentic research method. I would love to hear which recipe she's most curious about because there's a lot out there. I know.
But part of the problem in looking at British recipes is they're using different weights, aren't they?
It's more, I might make it completely accurately. I might make it exactly the way Elizabeth David intended, and we may not like it at all. Our tastes are much sweeter, much richer than they were in the past. We use much nicer ingredients in a way, and some of them nicer, some of them much cheaper. So there's so much variances in taste that, you know, I think the biggest thing is if it was a baking recipe, it'd probably be significantly less sweet than we think dessert should be.
Let's go to Nico. Hi, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, one of the things that I've always found is very helpful is, you know, if I'm doing something that I'm not too sure of, is to try to find either online or through cookbooks as many possible recipes of what it is I want to make and sort of lay them all out in front of me. And then you can sort of get an idea about what, you know, what the sort of, you know, general consensus is with something.
You have a lot of time on your hands.
You must drive yourself crazy. But no, I mean, I do the same thing too. I'm always looking at various versions.
Well, it's a good way to get an idea. I mean, at Cooks Illustrated, when we're about to develop a recipe, the first thing we do is take 5 to 10 of the recipes that we find for it and actually make them all, which, of course, you wouldn't do at home. But you sort of get the same idea by looking at the cookbooks. It's good to get a general idea of what people do and then go in the direction that you like.
Do you find some of them really disappointing? Are you surprised?
It's amazing. Many of them are really bad. So, you know, it's always a bit subjective because, you know, do you want a cakey scone or do you want a crumbly scone? Or, you know, there's a lot of subjective decisions to make. But there are a lot of bad recipes out there.
And then there's also a lot of conventional wisdom that we start reading doesn't really hold up. For example, like browning meat.
That's my favorite. Browning meat, seals, and the juices. I mean, Harold McGee, I think back in the 70s, or at least the 80s, showed that that wasn't true, but you still hear it all the time.
I've said it before, and I always get a tisk-tisk from commenters. I know, it's almost habit, because, you know, you're trying to explain why you're doing it, and it's really, I agree. I've made that mistake many times.
That's because it's a tradition that, by the way, has been passed on by many people who write recipes.
Mm-hmm. I'm part of the problem, guys. Don't
It's like writing history. You copy a story and long enough, it becomes true.
Just one more thing. A listener wonders whether she can substitute buttermilk for milk and vice versa.
I wouldn't.
Uh-huh. It really changes the recipe that
again,
much.
Again, it's the acidity. It can change the reactions of the baking powder or baking soda, which we both keep forgetting which one.
Yeah, but,
but, thank
but
you.
It does act differently chemically.
Thank you both so much for being with us, John Doc Willoughby, the executive editor of the America's Test Kitchen Cookbooks, and Deb Perlman, author of the popular blog smittenkitchen.com. And it's been a lot of fun talking with you. And thank you all of you who have written in. And by the way, we have a couple of recipes on our blog, The Lowdown. You might want to check them out and compare them.